You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest today is Paul Lazar, an award-winning actor, director, teacher, and often dancing performer who many may know best for his appearances in more than 30 feature films, including Silence of the Lambs, Snowpiercer, and Philadelphia. His principal roots are in theater, and he is a founding member and co-artistic director with Annie B. Parson of Big Dance Theater, appearing in works for Big Dance since 1991. He came to my attention months ago through the enthusiastic critical response to his Cage Shuffle, a 50-minute dance theater solo in which he speaks a series of one-minute stories by John Cage from his score Indeterminacy, while simultaneously performing a complex choreographic score by Parson. The piece has seen many iterations, but in all of them, Cage's stories are spoken in random order with no predetermined relationship to the dance, yet chance serves up its inevitable blend of uncanny connections between text and movement. Cage's humor, intellect, and iconoclasm find new expression in Lazar's realizations, which add dance to Cage's original performance instructions, which are read stories aloud, paced so that each story takes 1 minute, using chance procedures or not. Realizations of Cage's works that cross artistic mediums are not common, so this work intrigued me. In such adaptations, aspects of Cage's originals are often subtly or not so subtly changed, with luck not only being moving and entertaining in and of themselves, but bringing new ways of seeing, hearing, and understanding the underlying work. My own adaptation for the stage version of Cage's Marcel Duchamp, James Joyce, and Eric Satie, and Alphabet, which was the subject of a program for All Things Cage a few weeks ago, is a case in point. I was curious to speak with Paul about his directorial decisions. What was he trying to do? What were his aesthetic goals, if you will, with this adaptation? Our initial conversation was interesting to me and also a great pleasure, and led us to tonight's program. While we're only going to be able to listen to Cage reading stories from his Indeterminacy in tonight's program, with David Tudor at the piano, you can access video clips of Lazar's Cage Shuffle via two Vimeo links on our broadcast page. Welcome to All Things Cage, Paul.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the genesis of the piece. How did Cage Shuffle come to be?
It started with a wonderful contemporary composer who's in his own way in the lineage of Cage, I think, David Lang. David Lang curated a series at Carnegie Hall in 2014 called Collected Stories. And some of his compositions were in it, but also compositions and creations, you might say, of David's. And one of David's creations was a piece of his in which he put these elements together. He put the percussionist Stephen Schick playing a Cage percussion piece on the stage. And he put me on the stage. Stephen Schick was off to the left. I was more on the center of the stage, just with a little reading light. And that was kind of the only light on stage, was the reading light, which illuminated the cards upon which are written the text of Cage's 90 stories, which he wrote for his piece Indeterminacy. Anyway, I read 20 to 30 of these stories while Stephen Schick was playing Cage's percussion piece. And Cage had said that this specific percussion piece was appropriate to play during the reading of the stories that Cage wrote.
So you were reading these stories. Stephen Schick was playing this percussion piece by Cage. Was there anything else going on?
There was. David decided to have lighting effects be dictated by the dictates of Cage's piece Fontana Mix. So it was a David Lang creation using the raw materials of John Cage's work. And so I was introduced to these Cage stories that way by David Lang, who then, David is a teacher as well as a great composer and a very good friend. And he often nudges me anyway in the right direction. Somehow he suggested that I go forward with these stories in some way, do more with them on my own. So the next step for me, I guess I was in the mindset of, from the David Lang creation, of putting things side by side. Well, and of course it's so in the Cage tradition, putting two things side by side that don't have an inherent connection. Uh-huh. So I put together about 20 minutes initially of choreography from my and Annie B. Parsons' theater company, Big Dance. And over our years of Big Dance Theater, Annie has choreographed a great deal of dance. I took 20 minutes of Annie's choreography and under her eye, knitted it together and created a fixed choreographic sequence that I danced. At the same time, I spoke these Cage stories. But even though the movement is fixed, the stories, I spoke them in random order. I did that by having my iPhone on with the Cage stories on my iPhone, and I would hit, what's the random setting? Hit shuffle. Oh, that's right. That's the name,
Cage. Shuffle. Excuse me, shuffle.
You'd think I'd remember. See, that's why I have to be fed the lines through my ear. I can't even remember the title of the piece.
I saw that you had an ear thing. Are you using an ear prompter? Is that the technology you're using? Are you speaking your texts as they're read to you by yourself?
I'm speaking the text as they're read to me by John Cage.
Uh-huh. So you have Cage in your ear.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So I have Cage's voice speaking the story, and I repeat it. As he says it, I repeat what he says, and I've gotten skillful enough at it over the years so that I'm almost speaking simultaneously with Cage. So, but I'm just a hair behind, and that allows me to maintain the pauses that Cage very consciously put into the stories, because the each story he very intentionally made exactly 1 minute long. And I'm glad we'll be playing at some point, I believe we'll play examples of this. So if the story is a short story, a small story, he'll put pauses in between sentences or in the middle of sentences to stretch the story out to make it exactly a minute long. Or if it's a long, elaborate story, he'll talk at lightning speed, very fast, to make it exactly a minute long. So the game that took me about a year to get to where I could play it was to be able to hear these Cage stories in random order and speak them as I heard them while simultaneously dancing a fixed choreographic score.
Got it.
And the thing that made me, because it took a lot of work, the thing that made me keep going, keep working at it till I cracked it, was that the connection between the movement and the words I was speaking and the stories I was telling, or images from the stories, there was such connection between the movement and the stories. Regardless of the randomness of how these two elements are put together, they connected so uncannily. I think maybe perhaps because of the randomness, they connect so uncannily. So it's sort of living, thrilling proof of my interpretation of Cage's idea that things connect or don't, which is also exciting when they just sit side by side and have no apparent connection. Then that's two things going on at once that have nothing to do with each other. And that's kind of beautiful too. I always think of it as realism. I know it's considered great abstraction, but what could be realer? I mean, I'm looking at, as I talk to you now, we're on Zoom. So I'm looking out your back window and there's something going on out there. There's motion and color, and it's living in parallel with looking at the movements of your eyelids. It's things going on simultaneously that don't in any conscious way connect. So
right. They don't have an inherent connection. There's no, yeah, absolutely. Cage would approve entirely.
You know, my happiest quotation is Yvonne Rainer saw Cage shuffle. And after it was over, she said to me, John would have loved this. I could have fallen on the floor. I was so happy to hear that thought.
Let me stop us for a second and just tell our listening audience that in Cage's conception of indeterminacy, there were, in fact, 90 stories. There are more than 90 stories, actually, but the 90 stories are as these were published in a set based on the number of indeterminacy stories Cage himself recorded on the Folkways label. So that's why there are those 90 that are published in a box set in the performance edition available from C.F. Peters. But in point of fact, there are more than 90 stories. But when Cage performed them, as he initially thought of it, it was him reading the stories, as Paul explained, in 1 minute precisely, some of them quite funny because they had to be read so fast that you could barely understand them. And some of them are so slow, you think they're done long before they're done. And then here comes another sentence. But he's also got music being performed by David Tudor, often, by the way, from Fontana Mix or driven by Fontana Mix in terms of its makeup. So you have music and speech going on. That in Cage's conception, that's primarily what it was. But then as time went on, it began to morph into other things, getting a little closer to what you're doing, Paul, which is to say that Cunningham said, I'm going to make a dance and I need music. And Cage said, why don't you use some indeterminacy stories? So there is a piece in Cunningham's catalog, if you will, which is called How to Pass, Kick, Run, and Fall. And it is, like yours, fixed choreography, wherein John Cage alone or John Cage and another person would read indeterminacy stories, either chosen by chance or just because they were favorites. And they would read these stories live and the stories would change. So you have a fixed choreography and stories that would randomize, very much like the Cage-Cunningham collaboration with indeterminacy. In both cases, very different than what Cage had originally conceived.
Interesting. I mean, I guess the only difference, which is not a small difference, but all these iterations have their own character and quality, is in my case, the dancer is the one speaking the stories.
That's correct. You're doing all of it. You're like John Kelly in Alphabet.
True.
Yes,
true.
That is true. The other glaring thing for me, and I can't help but when I first saw your work to notice the distinctions, like what is it that this piece does that the Cage piece didn't do? And the biggest thing that stuck out to me was Cage's use of a collaborative partner, being a musician, playing electronic sounds largely. It could change. You could do that with almost anything. But David Tudor chose to use electronic sounds, which at times actually covered up Cage's voice. Like he'd be in the middle of a story and David Tudor would go bang, 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 and you'd miss two sentences. So we never have that in yours. It's very clear. We never lose the clarity of the central performer. Whereas with Cage, we did. I forget why I'm telling you that.
Yeah, it's quite a difference. I mean, in other words, Cage, it's sort of what's implicit in what he was doing with Tudor is he's telling the story, Tudor's making sound. And at times the story is in the foreground, but at times the sound that Tudor's making is in the foreground. The implication being, you know, it's all sound. And sometimes one thing's more important than the other and sometimes not. And sometimes the quack is... covers
the point.
You know, and it's a kind of evenness, non-judgment about centrality.
Yes.
Whereas my performance absolutely insists on the centrality of the story, I guess. I mean, the movement is equal to it, but the movement and the story don't go to war with each other.
Right. It's because they're different mediums. It's because you've chosen to parse the piece into two mediums that don't fight with each other.
Yeah, they cohabitate better. Although, yes, as a performer, the thing I learned, which was also an exciting challenge that also helped motivate me to keep working on it, is when I was speaking and moving, there's a certain kind of speaking that's understandable, that makes the story comprehensible, that you need to cultivate in order to be comprehensible. Because if somebody's moving and speaking at the same time and the movements don't necessarily literally correlate to the speaking, you don't understand what the hell they're saying. Unless you vivify what you're saying sufficiently so that it cuts through the movement. And so you really can get the story and the movement. For a long time, it took all of my concentration just to get the words out, as opposed to express them. But I discovered that I really had to be quite specific and expressive with the words for them to be comprehensible as something other than just a sequence of verbal sound. So it was a performance challenge that evolved over time.
I can imagine that easily. I'm thinking of a kind of a very mundane metaphor for this. It would be like if you were called upon to make an angry face, but your text was loving words. And how do you do that? You know, how do you do something which is reading one way to your audience and text is reading another way? So you would have this performer's pressure to over externalize the meaning of the words because you're doing something which is potentially confounding them.
Yeah, I think that's well described. In early iteration of the Cage Shuffle, what I did was I told a series of the stories, maybe 20 to 30, somewhere in there. Then I would go back and dance all the dance I had done during the time of the telling of the stories a second time without the stories. And it had an interesting component, which is the stories then in the mind of the audience were associated with certain movement. So when they saw the dance without the stories, patches of the stories would be revisited in the mind of the audience because they associated the movement. And initially I had a sound artist who I met at the McDowell writing retreat, which is where I first started working on Cage Shuffle, developing it. And
what year was this, Paul? What year?
Boy, that's a really good question. I would guess about 2016, but it's just
okay.
And it's the first time I performed it. It was at the library there. And there was a sound artist there, a woman named Leah Bertucci, very gifted. And for the first maybe number of performances of Cage Shuffle, when I would go back and dance through the movement a second time without the Cage stories, I would have Leah created a sound composition that she would play live at the same time, which was cool. I mean, I liked it a lot. Ultimately, I kind of pared the elements down to primarily, as I speak about it, I realize there are different iterations. Then I went through a phase where when I would dance back through the movement a second time, I would first on a old-fashioned phonograph put the Cage recording of Dream on and dance through it while playing Dream. This is just by way of saying I'm still playing with it.
It's interesting. Do you know his opera? It's called Your Operas 1 and 2.
No.
Okay, well, it's a very long work, 2.5 hours. It's a collage piece. It brings together, I wrote a dissertation on this piece. You would think I would know all of this data by heart, which I don't. But it's like, you know, 128 operas are all chopped up like ground meat and made into the score for the orchestra. And then the singers themselves would choose their own arias from operas, which were not necessarily in the score, but in public domain. And they're wearing costumes having nothing to do or something to do with their roles associated with their arias. They have props that have nothing to do with anything. They have stage movement, which is on a grid-like pattern. So that, and sometimes they're singing in the dark. They may or may not be lit properly. All of this is to say that this is a fantastically complicated collage work, but it's in response to what you were just saying about your rehearsing, your practicing, your ways of approaching the work. Cage used to tell his singers that they should begin as quickly as possible singing their arias in every single setting they could think of where there was also other things going on. So they should sing with the television on, sing with the radio on, sing when their children are in the house. They should just be able to do this without any consideration for other things that are happening. I can see, though, in your case, it's quite confounding, potentially, because both things, the external and the internal, if you will, are happening in the same person. Mm-hmm. It's not like you are drowning out Charlie over there.
Yes.
You know? It's like you're trying to drown out you.
Yeah. Very tricky. Yeah, it's crazy.
And another thing, Paul, I just want to add one more thing, because why Cage would like this, and I think Yvonne Rainer was exactly right, is that one of the things that Cage really, really sought in his compositional work was to, he would try to create work for you to do that would push you to a place where you would discover that you could do something that you didn't know you could do. So he would write music for a string player who didn't know how to play four strings at a time, you know, and somebody would invent a round bow for that purpose. Or he was constantly trying to help performers move beyond their own self-imposed limitations. Players make discoveries about themselves through the works that he made for them. And that's exactly what you're describing.
Yeah. Absolutely. He found strategies for doing that. Strong impulse within him that he formulated strategies for pushing past the edges of what's seemed appropriate and possible.
It's interesting because you've blended, going back to this business of Cage creates this piece, and for him it's spoken word by one person, sound being created by another person using electronic instruments and having those happening simultaneously. Or you have one speaker or two speakers. And by the way, you do a duo version of this piece with Bibi. Is that the only person you have performed with this piece?
Yes. So glad you brought that up, because I really wanted to speak about that particular iteration of Cage Shuffle, which the occasion of this conversation with you is what makes me realize how many iterations of Cage Shuffle have existed so far. But to me, maybe the most significant one is that I created and it was performed at the Wexner Center and then rebroadcast at the Black Mountain Museum, a duet version of Cage Shuffle where I tell some of the stories and B.B. Miller tells some of the stories. So it's a duet version with the great choreographer, performer, dancer, B.B. Miller. B.B. and I worked for about a month, and the fact that B.B. could get to the point of being able to move, do movement, and tell the stories within a month's time, she did in a month what it took me a year to do. Mm-hmm. I have to admit that I selected stories that were more handleable, the slower ones, so that, you know, it was physically possible. But nonetheless, it was a remarkable feat that B.B. could do them. And another person in the collaboration that was so important was the person, because it was this iteration called Cage Shuffle, a digital duet, was created during the pandemic. I risked going out to the Wexner Art Center in Columbus, where B.B. lives, to create this. But it was seen only, there was no live performance of it. Because it was the pandemic, it was made on video, and the video designer is named Eamon Farrell, and he had a very wonderful conception of it, which is that he put two video cameras facing in opposite directions in the center of the room, and that allowed B.B. and I to dance this piece and do the stories facing each other. And then he would intercut between the two. It was beautifully formulated from a video standpoint.
So, you know, Paul, that's really brilliant on so many levels. But one of the levels is during the pandemic, it was like you were the audience for each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty clever.
Yeah,
that's very much what you just said was very much, I think, a motivating factor. That's just the idea of us being present for one another was what was possible, and that's the thing. That the quality of that is something that Eamon wanted to share with the isolated audience.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Otherwise, it would have been you, her, and say me watching, you know.
Exactly.
So this three sort of corners of a triangle that never actually
connect,
you know, where right. At least I got right. to be present as one of those in this triangle to watch the other two points of the triangle connect. And that would be
amazing. Yeah, and he unfolded that revelation in a skillful, gradual way. He would show me, he would show BB, a straight-on shot of us, and then eventually show that the two of us together. And so the revelation that we're literally in the same room together, which at that time was quite a revelation because people kind of were discouraged from being in the same room.
Right, right. And people were doing a lot of work where they weren't in the same room, but pretending they were.
Yes.
So there was a lot of sleight of hand going on.
And the feeling, of course, is so different when you can say the story to someone as opposed to saying it to the camera. Mentioning the duet brings to mind for me another aspect of working on these Cage stories over a long period of time, because I've been using them and making these iterations of this piece and so living with the story since 2017, or well, first with David Lang, 2014, so for a long time. And Cage's mentality, his spirit infuses, it sinks deeper and deeper into you, into me anyway, and obviously just having that text in me for so long, and so much about it is so life-giving because of his ability to be light and playful and deeply serious about the life experience. A thing, though, also that I noticed was part of what made it possible for him to traffic in this fluid, beautiful, playful, skillful way was through the stories you experience his ability to be anonymous when he wants to be just a fly on the wall and watch the world happen, or to be the center of attention when he wants to be the center of attention and be a performer. And he could transit between anonymity and visibility at will. This is something that just I sort of soaked up gradually. And I thought that is a privilege to be able to sink into the woodwork unnoticed and describe situations and places that he loved looking at from his playful, provocative perspective. But it's a privilege that not all of us have. And, you know, I would say my primary, BB and I's primary purpose in working together is that we're artistically, we have such an attraction to one another's way of performing and moving and talking, all of it, all those elements. I love the way BB does that. And she's interested in the way I do it. So when I suggested to her that we do this thing together, she was like, wow, that sounds fun. And that's just two artists being artists in each other's midst. That's how these things happen. So that's the soul of it. At the same time, BB's female, I'm male. BB's black, I'm white. So when BB says a Cage story, particularly the ones that have to do with anonymity, and it comes out of the voice and out of the consciousness of somebody who isn't always allowed at that level of anonymity because, you know, our culture has a point of view or an anxiety or whatever you want to say toward those in it that are not the predominant figures, it's really a different story coming out of BB than coming out of me, I guess.
Right.
The way of putting it. And I thought doing this piece with BB would get into that water. which is also a way of expanding what the subject matter of the cage material is in a, into a new direction.
You bring up something that I would love to ask you about, and that is when I raised the subject of the duet performance, which is, by the way, the only one that I've seen from start to finish. So it's the one that you did with Bebe Miller. And in fact, I saw it on as it was hosted by the Black Mountain Museum and Arts Center. But my question had to do with one of the things that happens when you do the duet performance that doesn't happen when you do solo performance. Same for Cage. When Cage would do readings of the piece with the Cunningham Dance Company, he would sometimes have a partner to read with. All of this is a prelude to my question. I was happy to see that it happened in your duet performance with Bebe Miller, that you read stories at the same time, that that happened, but not very frequently. And am I wrong in remembering that you actually both did the same story at the same time? And was that a chance occurrence?
Right. We did the story, we did it in sequence where I told the story and then Bebe told it right after.
That was it. I do remember this. Was that by chance? Did that happen?
No, that was initially in the rehearsal phase that occurred by chance. But then we started to consider the resonances of that. And we made sure that it happened in the recorded performance.
I see.
So that was placed there.
Yeah.
And I always love, just as a general rule, being free with the orthodoxies of any rules. You know, there's something reverential about the pure, unvarnished respect for the notion of putting random things together. And that is the essential ethic from which this piece was born. But I, at times, like to violate that ethic because I feel like it.
Uh-huh. I wasn't chastising you. I rather liked it. When it happened, I remember thinking, wow, that's really interesting. And it epitomizes, Paul, exactly the thing that you were talking about, that the story came out of your mouth and then it came out of Bebe's. Or vice versa, I don't remember, and it doesn't matter. But the stories were fundamentally different out of those two.
Same words.
Same words, different voices. So that when Cage did it as one in a duo, I'm not sure that that ever happened, although I don't know, but each performer is free to choose their own program. And Cage, of course, said, I'd like you to use chance, you know, to determine it. As the piece is only like, I think it's a half hour long or 23 minutes, the dance work. Mm-hmm. So they could only choose that many stories. Mm-hmm. And Cage would say, and then you can choose them by chance. David Vaughan, who was the archivist for Cunningham, very British, very stiff upper lip kind of fellow with the soul of an imp, he would always choose the same stories. He loved the stories about Merce Cunningham's mother, for example. So he always chose the same stories, which I think delighted Cage on some level, you know.
Yeah.
But they also got to choose, while they had to stick with the 1 minute times, they each could create their own programs. So if they had, say, 23 minutes or whatever that length is, each could choose up to 23 stories. They could also choose five and place those. And so that you ended up with each performing potentially having different densities. You would have overlap, you would have stories on top of each other, which kind of did the music, you know, collapsing onto Cage throughout the performance. So anyway, I'm all for that. And as I told you on the phone in our first conversation, I'm really interested in what Cage is doing now. So if you don't do what he did, but do something else, I kind of think he's doing that now. You know,
love that thought. Whoever's working with Cage's material now is what Cage is doing now. I love that.
I think it's true because the works are malleable. You know, you can muck about with them without destroying them. You know, it doesn't change anything that you and Bebe read the same story back to back because you liked it. Nothing is ruined. Nothing. There's room for everything, you know. And that's very Cage. That is very Cage. Now, that isn't to say that I want you to do it naked, standing on your head, you know, and read the text backwards so that it becomes illegible. Then it doesn't make much sense to me. So that's my own bias. But I thought it
would really well. I'll have to note that.
And don't do it naked. I can see those wheels turning in your head when I said that. Don't do it naked. And don't do it standing on your head. There's Paul. Do it standing on my head.
There's a story of, in a sense, I think a theater artist who's maybe, shall we say, like a fan, part of the Cage lineage, in some sense, Richard Foreman.
Sure.
Who... The story goes, I asked Foreman about this and he kind of wasn't so sure it was the truth, but nonetheless, it kind of still holds, that the great French actor Jean-Louis Barrault saw a Richard Foreman piece performed in Paris. And Barrault said to Richard Foreman, you know, this text that you've created and the way it's performed, it's as if there's just a giant window of plexiglass between the audience and the performers. He said, you know, as a criticism. And from that point forward, Foreman always put a giant plexiglass window between the audience and performers.
So you got to be careful what you say, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it became kind of a signature thing.
Did he put courtesy of Barrault in the program?
Yeah, right. He should have had Barrault sign it like a painting on the lower right corner.
Too funny. So tell me about this piece and you now. Like, what are you going to do?
Yes.
You had shared some thoughts with me, but talk about that. Where are you going to go with it?
I'm going to do all 90 stories in one performance. I put 9 seconds between each story. So it'll be a performance that's about an hour and 45 minutes long. And it'll be all the stories. I am going to do it at La Mama Theater in tentatively the fall. We're going to wait until audiences at full capacity. So we'll see when, but probably this fall. I love the idea. Okay, so the pandemic plays a role in this, in that it gave me the opportunity, the complete cessation of my professional life, gave me the opportunity to put together enough movement so that I could, because an hour and 45 minutes of Cage stories requires an hour and 45 minutes of movement to be made. And so I just kept adding and adding and adding. The initial portion of it is Annabee Parsons' choreography. Then I choreograph a bunch. Then I went back to pieces of ours from our archive and took dances out of that, which is Annabee Parsons' choreography, as well as Timberlee Canale's choreography. She choreographed one of the dances there. And then I got to an hour's worth of movement, which I had memorized. It's still not enough. So my latest idea is, after dancing an hour's worth of movement, I'm learning the same movement backwards. So I've got a friend of mine who I videoed my movement, and then he's reversing the tape, which is maddening and difficult, but it's quite wonderful. And it goes to this Cage idea that you were just speaking about, where he pushes, we spoke about musicians, to play things that they would never play. Doing a dance that you know backwards, your body moves in ways you would never choose. And it's quite lovely and tickles some part of your unconscious mind in a way that makes you like, why am I laughing right now? you just push out past the way your muscles habitually move. Right, so I love doing it backwards.
You know, Paul, this, yeah. Forgive me for interrupting, but it's just quite so apropos. There is, I just heard it recently on NPR, some program about brain health, and the bottom line of this very long, very erudite doctor talking about brain health had to do with that one of the best things that you can do for yourself while you have all your faculties, as you clearly do right now, is to do things that you normally do, but do them differently. for example, if you are right-handed and you eat with your right hand, once a week, eat with your left hand. Wow. That it's really good for your brain. Really, really good. Because the brain is nothing but the brain has all these sort of grooves, and we're wearing those grooves down when we always eat this way. So turn it to the other hand and it makes different grooves in the brain. So it allows rest. And isn't that interesting?
It is interesting. And I hope there's some truth to it.
No, I think this is the latest thing. This is like right. really understanding this. So I think you're ensuring yourself immortality is what you're doing.
That's what I was after. So I'm glad that's actually going to occur.
Just keep it up. Keep it up. Just dance backwards for the next couple of years.
Next 100. Another element this version iteration where I do all the stories. Well, there's two things about it that I wanted to mention. One is that I got this idea to include the artistic community wherever it is that I perform it. In the case of La Mama, it'll be in New York. By every, I don't know how many stories, 10, 15 or whatever, I'll take the occasion to rest by having someone else do a story. So I hope to have 10 or 15 guests, just from my estimation, luminaries of the non-traditional theater, or maybe some from the traditional theater.
I love this. I love this idea. I think it's great.
Oh, good, good, good. And I think about your piece Alphabet, because Cage, you know, the material for that was artists who he loves, and including them or making them quite central to that piece. So I like the idea of, you know, at this point, I've worked in the downtown theater for most of my adult life. So to have figures from that world that extended family in the piece seems right. Also because of Cage's importance in the aesthetic of the non-traditional dance and theater. It's important, I think, or a nice idea to expand the cast in that.
Yeah, I loved it. I loved, you know, just bringing this really seasoned little troupe with me and then integrating them with local people. And sometimes the local people were students, but other times I remember one of the players was the vice president of the Bank of Scotland. One was a provost in Scotland, or vice provost. We had a television personality from the Australian broadcasting system. He was a newscaster. Anyway, it was just an amazing way to bring people who are otherwise not exposed to theater in that way, who were really not even dilettantes. They were people who just dipped in and watched it with their wives or their husbands. Mm-hmm. These were people who were potentially very helpful to artists, you know, economically helpful, societally helpful. There were all kinds of ways that they could be helpful.
Yeah.
And to bring them in, I felt really good about doing that. And they were really fun to have on the stage, you know?
That's encouraging. Because this is an idea I have in my head that I have yet to try out.
Well, it plays with two things. Not only what I did with Alphabet, that blending of the two kinds of players, but it also plays with a thought that I had. You, of course, know the work of Robert Wilson.
Yeah.
Well, Robert Wilson did a run of Cage's Lecture on Nothing, which is just a performance piece. It's just a text that Cage would have sat there with a little tiny light, just like you did with the Indeterminacy stories with David Lang, except that Cage would sit there for 90 minutes doing these stories for Indeterminacy. Well, Cage would lecture on nothing, which is only about 40 minutes. So that when Robert Wilson took this on the road, I went to see it, and he had fixed staging for the work as he did it, which included about, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes where he laid in bed. So I thought, you know, you could just take little breaks. You mm-hmm. could just lie down. You mm-hmm. could mm-hmm. sit in a chair and read your stories in a newspaper. You literally could introduce stasis instead of having constant activity.
Yeah.
There's so many creative ways to deal with the demands that this is going to put on you.
Right. That's a nice thing to open up my thinking about that.
Because, you know, it's the world's your oyster with this.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Another aspect of why I'm interested in doing all 90 stories is that I've been, even when I did 20 or 30, I was aware of the audience going through different phases. You know, there's interludes where they're very giddy and the stories happen to go in a sequence that's overtly entertaining, like, you know, getting a lot of laughs, and because there's the stories are really witty and funny and irresistible.
Yeah, the one of my favorites is the Aunt Marge story.
Yes.
The washing machine. You know, I
love this washing machine more than I love your uncle
Walter. I just love this story. Every time I hear it, it just cracks me up. And audiences always laugh because it's like humanity on a plate. You know, it's like you get this. You know, she doesn't love it more than Uncle Walter. We know that, but we get that.
It's everything
about being a woman. It says everything about marriage, all in this one tiny little story.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Anyway, so you have an audience corpse.
Oh, yeah. So the audience goes through it, and then there are phases where the stories are, you know, where the audience has a kind of quietness because it induces reflection. I think the audience gets bored in places, all of the above. And a way in which I was more and more and more aware the more I performed it, in which Cage and I differ, is his courage to have people go through different experiences. He's comfortable with them falling asleep, being antsy, all of it. And going back to David Lang described the 8-hour piece of Cage's that starts at midnight and goes through the morning, and how going through all those phases that you go through when you're experiencing an 8-hour piece leads you to a place that you could never get to if you just stayed in the arena of, I've been amused for an hour and now it's time to go home. What I call the ordeal, the value of the ordeal. And Cage was, you know, so courageous in his willingness to subject his audience to this ordeal, which led them to all kinds of places they'd never get to otherwise. The hard road with a really valuable transcendent payoff. And so I just feel like I've done so much of these performances, and I'm as an entertainer, actor, whatever, highly desire to always be amusing and to minimize the amount of what we associate as a negative experience for audience of
discomfort.
Yeah. That I said, I've got to push it. And I've got to do this hour and 45 minutes. And it you know, that's a lot of time from my perspective to have people sit and listen to me speaking Cage's work. So the aspect of ordeal that's implicit in doing all of it is something I'm kind of interested in engaging in.
I think that's a totally reasonable thing to ask of yourself at this point, because you've been living with this piece for a long time now, and I'd like you not to leave it until you exhaust it, you know, if not yourself.
Well, I think both will happen.
You know, I remember though, I myself performed Lecture on Nothing off and on for a number of years, and in Cage's Lecture on Nothing, the same piece that Robert Wilson is doing, there is a section about 2/3 of the way through. So at the maybe 25 minute mark, you have to be silent for, I forget the period of time, maybe 3 minutes, but you've been talking nonstop. And now you've come to this part. And it is, when I first did this, the first few times I did it, it was perilous. Those minutes of complete silence were like, they were excruciating. Because I was so aware of the edginess in the audience of, why is she being quiet? Why is she not talking? Are we done? Is it, you know, I could feel that in every direction. And just about the time I couldn't stand it anymore, I could read again. And the whole audience, you could feel the whole audience, their shoulders dropped, you know. So I look forward to talking to you once again after you maybe get into this more endurance version. This is Cage Shuffle on steroids or something.
Yeah, I have no doubt that there'll be aspects of that experience for both my experience of the audience and the audience's experience of me that will be something I won't anticipate or be able to imagine that will transpire.
It's a good exercise. You know, it's a good exercise of just being with other people without ideas about other people. It brings all of that right in your face, you know? Anyway, we have to go. It's our time is up. The party's over.
The timing was perfect.
It was very perfect. It was. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Paul.
My pleasure.
I look forward to seeing whatever you do next.
Well, that's great. I will keep you completely apprised of what I'm up to.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. We said that simultaneously.
I know. There's something sexy about that. I don't know. Take care of yourself.
You too, Laura.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Before we listen to John Cage and David Tudor perform a few of Cage's indeterminacy stories, let me turn your attention once more to two Vimeo links provided on our broadcast page, whereby you can sample video clips of Lazar's work. Both Cage Shuffle in the original, performed solo by Lazar, and his beautiful derivative Cage Shuffle, a digital duet, performed by Lazar and B.B. Miller. Now on to John Cage and David Tudor, Indeterminacy.
This summer I'm going to give a class in mushroom identification at the New School for Social Research. Actually, it's 5 field trips, not really a class at all. However, when I proposed it to Dean Clara Meyer, though she was delighted with the idea, she said, "I'll have to let you know later whether or not we'll give it." So she spoke to the president, who couldn't see why there should be a class in mushrooms at the New School. Next, she spoke to Professor McIver, who lives in Piermont. She said, "What do you think about our having a mushroom class at the New School?" He said, "Fine idea. Nothing more than mushroom identification develops the powers of observation." This remark was relayed both to the president and to me. It served to get the class into the catalog and to verbalize for me my present attitude toward music. It isn't useful, music isn't, unless it develops our powers of audition. But most musicians can't hear a single sound, they listen only to the relationship between 2 or more sounds. Music for them has nothing to do with their powers of audition, but only to do with their powers of observing relationships. In order to do this, they have to ignore all the crying babies, fire engines, telephone bells, coughs that happen to occur during their auditions. Actually, if you run into people who are really interested in hearing sounds, you're apt to find them fascinated by the quiet ones. "Did you hear that?" they will say. In 1954, when I went to Europe, I no sooner arrived in Paris than I noticed that the city was covered with posters publicizing a mushroom exhibition that was being held in the Botanical Gardens. That was all I needed. Off I went. When I arrived, I found myself in a large room filled with many tables upon which were displayed many species of fungi. On the hour, from a large centrally placed loudspeaker, a recorded lecture on the deadly poisonous amanitas was delivered. During this lecture, nobody in the hall moved or spoke. Each person's attention was, so to speak, riveted to the information being given. A week later, I was in Cologne, in Germany, attending a concert of electronic music. There was also an audience and a large loudspeaker. However, many in the audience were dozing off, and some were talking to their neighbors. I went to a concert upstairs in Town Hall. The composer whose works were being performed had provided program notes. One of these notes was to the effect that there is too much pain in the world. After the concert, I was walking along with the composer, and he was telling me how the performances had not been quite up to snuff. So I said, "Well, I enjoyed the music, but I don't agree with that program note about there being too much pain in the world." He said, "What? Don't you think there's enough?" I said, "I think there's just the right amount." In 1949, Merce Cunningham and I went to Europe on a Dutch boat. As we were approaching Rotterdam, the fog became so thick that landing was delayed. To expedite matters, the customs officials came aboard the boat. Passengers formed into lines and one by one were questioned. Merce Cunningham was in one line, I was in another. I smoke a great deal, whereas he doesn't smoke at all. However, he was taking 5 cartons of cigarettes into Europe for me, and I had that number myself. We were both traveling through Holland to Belgium and then France, and the customs regulations vary for all those countries with regard to cigarettes. For instance, you could at that time take 5 cartons per person into France, but only 2 per person into Holland. When I got to my customs officer, all of this was clear to both of us. Out of the goodness of his heart, he was reluctant to deprive me of my 3 extra cartons or to charge duty on them. But he found it difficult to find an excuse for letting me off. Finally, he said, "Are you going to go out of Holland backwards?" I said, "Yes." He was overjoyed. Then he said, "You can keep all the cigarettes. Have a good trip." I left the line and noticed that Merce Cunningham had just reached his customs officer and was having some trouble about the extra cartons. So I went over and told the official that Merce Cunningham was going to go out of Holland backwards. He was delighted. "Oh," he said, "in that case, there's no problem at all." About 10 years ago, down at Black Mountain College during a summer session, I arranged an amateur festival of the works of Erik Satie. There were altogether 25 concerts, most of them about 30 minutes long, but a few were longer. For each one, I prepared to talk about the music which was to be heard. This was necessary because most of the people there had a German point of view and the music I was presenting was French. Satie had little fondness for German music. He told Debussy, for instance, that what was needed was a music without any sauerkraut in it. And he remarked that the reason Beethoven was so well known was that he had a good publicity manager. So after about 10 of the concerts and talks, I gave a good-sized talk about music in which I denounced Beethoven. A few days later, Patsy Lynch, now Patsy Davenport, knocked on my door and said, "I think I understand what you said about Beethoven, and I think I agree. But I have a very serious question to ask you. How do you feel about Bach?" One day, I asked Schoenberg what he thought about the international situation. He said, "The important thing to do is to develop foreign trade." One day while I was composing, the telephone rang. A lady's voice said, "Is this John Cage, the percussion composer?" I said, "Yes." She said, "This is the J. Walter Thompson Company." I didn't know what that was, but she explained that their business was advertising. She said, "Hold on, one of our directors wants to speak to you." During a pause, my mind went back to my composition. Then suddenly a man's voice said, "Mr. Cage, are you willing to prostitute your art?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, bring us some samples Friday at 2. I did. After hearing a few recordings, one of the directors said to me, "Wait a minute." Then 7 directors formed what looked like a football huddle. From this, one of them finally emerged, came over to me and said, "You're too good for us. We're going to save you for Robinson Crusoe."